Okay, yeah, that wasn't a typo. Thanks very much for the invitation. And hopefully this is the correct version of the talk. So I'm going to be presenting joint work with quite a number of people, including people who are here, Rob Speckens, Miao Horodetsky, Fernando Brandao, Stephanie Benner, Joe, etc. And most I'll be presenting work from this set of three papers, although, especially towards the end, I'll mention some kind of future directions and more recent work as well. Good. So I think, I don't know if I need this here, but probably, I guess because this is a mixed audience, feel free to, I'll do a bit of a review of thermodynamics, and also feel free to interrupt me with questions because it's a mixed audience. So I think you probably all know that there's been, so far, at least two waves of thermodynamic research. In the original, in the history, originally, there was people like Carnot and Joule and Clausius who were coming from the point of view of a very operational engineering kind of picture. People were trying to develop steam engines and understand their properties, and so everything was being developed experimentally and phenomenologically. And from an engineering perspective, which I think is maybe a bit similar to today, where we're developing new physical laws coming from engineering like computer science and quantum information theory. So I think a very similar era to today in that respect. But people were plodding along experimentally, discovering the relationship between work and heat by sitting there with big engines and heating up water. And it was only later with Maxwell and Boltzmann and Gibbs that you started to understand this phenomenological theory from a more fundamental level as arising from statistical mechanics. I would say that we're entering a kind of a third wave of thermodynamic research, and as probably a lot of you have noticed, there's just been an explosion of research and results on this topic. And it's thermodynamics being viewed as an information theory. And I think this goes back to Maxwell and Maxwell's demon. So Maxwell introduced this demon that measures or looks at what side of the box some gas molecule is, and then depending on what side of the molecule, what side of the box the molecule is on, the demon puts in a piston and then extracts work from a heat bath. So here you have a demon who's extracting work from the demon's information about where the molecule is. So I think this was starting us on the road of viewing thermodynamics as an information theory. And people didn't understand this for quite a long time until eventually we had Charlie Bennett effectively using Landauer's principle to say, no, this demon is a physical object. We should treat the information that this demon has as being physical, as being understood as being not beyond the laws of physics. And therefore, we can excise Maxwell's demon and we can understand thermodynamics by looking at this demon and treating it physically. So that's obviously, I think if this conference is based on information and physics, I think this kind of goes back to Maxwell in a sense here. Okay. So I think that we now are trying to understand thermodynamics as an information theory, which means that we can bring all the tools from things like quantum information theory and bring it to bear on the subject matter. And we are entering a realm where we have a much more rigorous theory. So let me just give an outline of some of the results that I'll be mentioning in the talk. What we'll find is that you're probably used to the fact that we have a second law of thermodynamics. And what we're going to find is that there's actually going to be many laws of thermodynamics at the quantum scale. And even at the macroscopic scale, just that they all look the same. We're going to be able to compute the work that we can get or that is required to go from any state to any other state. And we're going to find that there's something strange called embezzling, which means that there are actually many second laws. There's many families of second laws. And I think this maybe is a challenge for people looking at the foundations of thermodynamics and trying to derive laws of thermodynamics from some more fundamental principles, that in the quantum case, you can get these kind of different families of second laws, depending on what your rules are. I'm going to reformulate the laws of thermodynamics. So what we're going to see is that the zeroth and first law, which were treated as on an equal footing in some sense to The second law, I'm going to argue that they actually have a different status, and we should think of them as defining for us what thermodynamics is, right? Whereas the second law is telling us what states we can go to. The zeroth and first just define thermodynamics. Right? And I'm going to use some, I'm probably not going to go into too much technical detail here, but just to say that these are some of the sorts of tools from quantum information theory which we can bring to bear to understand thermodynamics. This is not a very, this is kind of a, I wanted to say that there is a lot of work both before what I'm presenting and after, which have really kind of set the scene for this. So early works by Ruchin Mead and Dominic Janzing. There's work on deterministic state transformations going back to 2003, but also the Dalston et al. And Johan Auberg, various other results in this field. So Giulio talked about these nice interpretations of the heat bath in terms of purification. So these kinds of works getting at the foundations of thermodynamics. Okay, good. So with that, let's just start us on our road. So we're used to doing thermodynamics in the thermodynamic limit, right? We always derive our results, even in the statistical mechanics approach, by assuming that we have a very large system, and that will somehow damp out all the fluctuations, and we can only get our results when we take the thermodynamic limit. That's what where all our results are derived from, taking the large scale limit, the classical limit often. So we take the number of particles to be infinite. And what we're interested in here is thermodynamics of small systems. They could be quantum, they could just be, say, on the nanoscale. And here we don't have the thermodynamic limit. We are just looking at individual particles or a few particles of some finite size system. Or actually, we could be looking at a very large system, but maybe we have long range interactions. And if you have long range interactions, it also doesn't make sense to take the thermodynamic limit. And that includes gravity as well. So then what do we mean by quantum thermodynamics? Well, I guess we're looking at the case where we don't take a thermodynamic limit. We just have a few quantum particles. If it's a quantum state, then it can have coherences over energy levels. And because we just have a few quantum systems, we are able to exert a lot more control, possibly, over our system. We might even be able to access microscopic degrees of freedom of the heat bath. That's possible. And so we want to kind of relook at the question, what is thermodynamics in this regime? What do we mean by it? And I think that's a very useful thing, because I think what was lacking in previous generations and previous researchers' study of thermodynamics was, at least I never understood what thermodynamics was. People were doing things, but you never knew what are we allowed to do in thermodynamics? What are the rules of the game? You study something like electromagnetism, you know, you have your action. You study quantum field theory, you know what you're doing. You know what the rules are. But in thermodynamics, it's often very ad hoc. You can have a heat bath, you can do an adiabat, you can do an isotherm, you can do this and that, and it's never really clear what thermodynamics is. And I think now what we're able to say is, this is the rules of the game, this is what you're allowed, this is thermodynamics, and now let's see what the laws are given this fundamental set of rules, operations. And what we're going to see is I think we can think of the laws of thermodynamics in a very different way. So let me just review for you the old school three laws of thermodynamics. It's called the three laws because there's four of them. The zeroth one is essentially just defining what we mean by temperature, I think, in some ways. So if we have one system which is in equilibrium with another, and if and then we have a third system which is in equilibrium with the second system, then the first system is also in equilibrium with the third system. So it tells us, in some sense, what states of a different temperature, what defines that. It allows us to have this notion of stuff at the same temperature. The first law is effectively energy conservation, so that we can divide energy into heat and work. And then the second law, which everyone knows, because it means that things just get more chaotic as we go on in time, Heat can never pass from a colder body to a warmer body without some other change occurring, and that's the Clausius statement that I'll be interested in. There's various statements of the third law, and I've stuck in one of them, and Luis Massanas will be talking about this more in his talk on Friday. So let's just go to the first law. Originally, it was developed by Joule, found by Joule experimentally, but when you think about it, it's not really a law of thermodynamics. It's just saying energy is conserved. And so we should throw it out. It's not really a law of thermodynamics. We shouldn't consider it the law of thermodynamics. It's just a law of physics. It's defining what we're allowed to do. We have to conserve energy in the world. We don't have a choice in the matter. And so it's just conservation of energy. And I wouldn't consider it a law of thermodynamics necessarily. So I would say it's not a consequence of thermodynamics, but rather it's just part of the class of operations in thermodynamics. So we might have a work system, we might have a working body, we have a system, we have a reservoir, and the total energy of all these things needs to be conserved. And that's what the first law is effectively telling us. Right? So not thermodynamics. Let's go to the second law. So the second law, heat can never pass from a colder body to a warmer body. So we have a cup of coffee sitting in a cold room. It's going to get cold. We'd be very surprised if it spontaneously heated up. But there's an important point, which is no other change should occur elsewhere. So we can make a hot cup of coffee heat up in a cold room. All we do is we add a bit of work. We can imagine that we have some a weight with a big on a pulley, and we drop the weight a bit so we can do some work on our system, and then we can heat up the cup of coffee. So we need to be very careful that we should say no other change occurring. And then the second law, if we include this, the caveat that no other change occurs in the environment, then the second law becomes irrelevant, right? Because always some change occurs in the environment. So effectively, the second law now applies to physical situations which never occur in the real world. And so we need to think a bit more carefully about what we mean by no other change occurring in the environment. Or another way of putting it is we have some cyclic process, and the question is, how cyclic is it? Because no process is exactly cyclic. So we need to now reformulate the second law, thinking about things like, how cyclic is it? What do we mean by no other change occurring? Is that any questions about that? Yeah.
Are you taking temperature as primitive now?
I'm usually in that going to assume, I'll get to that, but usually I'll assume that we have access to some heat bath at a temperature T.
Okay, and you have a notion of relative temperature.
We'll get
okay.
to that. Yeah. Okay. And I guess this kind of becomes important, this notion of how cyclic, or what do we mean by no other change occurring. It becomes important because when you're dealing with the thermodynamics of quantum systems, there we know you definitely don't do perfect transformations. We know from entanglement theory you never do perfect transformations. You're always doing something which looks high in fidelity to what you imagined. Now, you're probably all thinking, oh, this is just silly. I just say, well, it's approximately cyclic. So as long as, or the environment should have some, if I look at the fidelity of the environment before and after, then I just want that the change in the environment is small, some epsilon. All right? That's what you probably would imagine. It turns out that can be a disaster. If you give me any epsilon and say that the environment should be the same up to that epsilon, I will be able to violate the second law of thermodynamics. So that turns out not to be the case. Okay. Because I mentioned that the first law is not really a law of thermodynamics, I like to just throw it in with the second law. I like to just include it. We can just use it. And then the second law becomes just the fact that in any cyclic process, the free energy of a system can only decrease. Is that familiar to everyone? The free energy is always going down, right? That's a nice formulation of the second law. And it's also one with a nice geometric. It's been known that it has a nice geometric interpretation. Right? So there's the free energy. We have some, just usually the average energy minus tau, where T is the temperature of the heat bath that we have available to us, times the entropy of the system. And so if we have some system out of equilibrium, then the free energy says that the second law says that the free energy has to go down. So the free energy provides what we say is a monotone, which tells us what state you can go to, because you can only go to another state of your system which has a lower free energy. And what the free energy also says, it plays a double role. So it tells us what kind of state transformations are allowed, but it also tells us how much work we can extract from a system out of equilibrium, or even any system. It tells us that the work we can gain, or the work we need to put into our system, is just equal to the difference in free energy between the initial state and the final state. All right? So two roles for the free energy. One, it tells us what state transformations are possible, and the other is it tells us how much work we can extract from a state transformation. Any questions? Okay, so now Steve asked about what we're allowed and about heat bath and stuff like that. So now I'm going to tell you what I mean by thermodynamics. I think I've picked we call this catalytic thermal operations. I think it's the kind of the largest class of thermodynamics you can imagine. So it includes, in my view, everything you could possibly be allowed to do in thermodynamics. So it's a very strong one. We're picking this kind of very strong view of thermodynamics, allowing the experimenter to do everything, because we want to derive limitations. So if you want to derive limitations, we should allow the experimenter to do whatever they can possibly do. In actual fact, they may be able to do a lot less, but that our restrictions will still apply. It strangely turns out that even though they can do a lot less, they may be able to do a lot less, they can still saturate our bounds. So the idea is in thermal operations, so this is this kind of information theoretic resource theory approach to thermodynamics. You have a system with some Hamiltonian HS. That's the system you're interested in. We call this a resource. It's a resource because we can extract work from it, potentially. We're allowed to add some free states, and let's just call them tau for the moment. These are going to turn out to be heat baths at some fixed temperature. But we're not going to put that in at the moment. We're going to derive that or justify that. We might have a work system, which is, I'm not going to say what that is, because it turns out that in some sense, there are things that depend on what that is. And we're allowed to borrow ancillas, maybe the working body, maybe it's our device, maybe it's just some ancillas that we use in our experimental process and then throw away. The box and the piston could be a working body. And then we need to return them in the same state, sigma c. So we have that's why it's called catalytic. You have some ancillas which you have to return back in the original state. And that's, even though it has we're calling it catalytic thermal operations, that's pretty standard in thermodynamics, where you have your piston and your device, and at the end of the cyclic process, you want to return them back in their original state. And now we have the first law, which, as I say, is just considered as part of the class of operations, is that we have to conserve energy, and that's because the laws of physics tell us we have to conserve energy. And lastly, we can throw stuff in the trash. Any questions about how we define thermodynamics and why that's thermodynamics?
The laws of physics wouldn't say as well that microscopic dynamics is unitary?
Yes, that's right. So I guess I could say that, I would say that this is effectively telling us what the laws of physics, these are all coming from the laws of physics, so they're very foundational. So we have to conserve energy. We can only do unitaries. We cannot do things. I mean, in some sense, the second law is going to arise, or what I would call this, the second law is going to arise from the fact that you can only do unitaries and you can't do something which maps many states to one state, for example. Okay. And here, for the purpose of this talk, what I'm going to consider to be work, I'm going to just do it in analogy with the classical case. So work, usually we have some weight which is lowered, which is, say, at some level, and then we consider that we have gained work if it gets raised later on, and vice versa. Here, we're going to have what we call a work bit or a wit. So it's in the ground state, and if we excite it, we've gained work. If we lower it, we've done work on our system.
You're trying to make a transition between rho S and Hamiltonian S to some other state?
Yes, and possibly some other Hamiltonian.
I was just wondering why you called it the resource.
I call it resource because in the theory of resource theories, you might have free states which you're allowed for free as part of their class of operations in some sense, and then anything which is not that free resource becomes a resource in the sense that it allows you to do transformations you would not otherwise be allowed to under the class of operations.
But it seems like it's the thing you want to do transformations on as well.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean.
It's clear what it is.
Yeah. I mean, so any state out of equilibrium is a resource because you can extract work. The Gibbs state may not be a resource because you can't. It doesn't take you out of the class of operations. I might, for whatever reason, unknown, I might want to try and be creating some state sigma, and I will therefore not be able to do it under the class of operations unless I get some resource states, which will allow me to
do it. So then sigma would be maybe replacing the
system. Sorry? That's sigma may be my targets. I might, let's call it rho prime. I might have some rho prime, which is my target state, and I want to go there. I can't go there under the class of operations unless I have some initial state, which is athermal.
So it's not like the W is your target system.
No, W, it may or may not be, but W is just maybe a resource as well. W is just some other ancillary system I may take the view that I should just consider W as being just another resource. That would be fair. But I want to separate it out because people assign it some special significance. I'm not sure that I do, actually, but people like to talk about work and how much work and all these sorts of things. All right, so what we mean by work is actually a process. Work is raising an energy level. The Bristol group often use a continuous system, like a proper weight, which can get raised and lowered. That's also a nice one to use. You can pick yours. So I want to recast the laws of thermodynamics, and I'm going to do it like this. I won't mention the third law, as mostly Luis will. So there's one law of thermodynamics. So the zeroth law, this is just the class of operations. The only free state, tau, which doesn't enable arbitrary transitions is the Gibbs state. So we allow this free resource. It turns out our theory will become completely trivial unless this free resource is the Gibbs state or the thermal state with some temperature T. Anything else will make our theory just trivial in the sense that we'll be able to do whatever we want and there'll be no interesting laws at all. So that's somehow you get the notion of temperature right there, kind of coming up, bubbling up from below without any assumptions. And as I mentioned, energy conserving unitaries, that's kind of like our first law or maybe even our second. And now, given this class of operations, we can ask what state transitions are allowed. So we want to go from some rho s to some other rho s prime. What are the allowed state transitions? Usually that's the second law, that the entropy, say, has to go up. The free energy has to go down, as we said. And here we find there's two versions of it. One for cyclic processes where we have an ancilla. And what we're going to find is that our resource has to get closer to the Gibbs state, to the thermal state, in terms of a bunch of free energy-like distances. So we're going to introduce a bunch of free energy-like distances and show that our state under thermodynamics has to get closer to the thermal state in terms of these new free energies. So previously we just had one free energy, and the one free energy said you're always getting closer to the Gibbs state. And now we have many of them. So that's one of the key differences. I should just say that for a single system, when we don't have an environment, then it's just something that we call thermomajorization. So let's go to the zeroth law. So there's something called passive states. A state is passive if, a state is passive if I order all the energies from lowest to from largest to smallest, then the probabilities, the associated probabilities, will also be ordered from lowest to smallest. Right? So in other words, you don't have an inverted population at any point. And there's a celebrated result due to Voronovich, which says that that if I have, say, if I'm allowed many of these states, then and then ask, is the ordering of the energy levels the same as the ordering of the probabilities, then that will only be true for the Gibbs state or the thermal state, right? And what we can do is we can find a way that if we have many copies of the state that's, say, not passive, then we can extract an arbitrary large amount of work from it, right? So in other words, you give me anything other than the Gibbs states, I'll be able to extract, or at least many copies of the Gibbs states, I'll be able to extract an arbitrary large amount of work just by changing the energy levels.
So this is a way to say that passive does not really capture what you really want, no?
Well, so that was known. Voronovich already quite early on knew that this passive itself is not enough. You need to have completely passive, because if you have many passive states, then it may no longer be passive. Mm-hmm. So in the resource theory, where I'm allowed an arbitrary big heat bath, I need to use the notion of completely passive. And I guess additionally, one can show that one can extract work from any other case. So you basically find that if I have anything other than the Gibbs state, then I can extract an arbitrary large amount of work in this resource theory. And so from a foundational point of view, you get the notion of temperature just coming out of the fact that you don't want your resource theory to be trivial. Questions about this? Now, the second laws, what they become in the case of states which commute with the Hamiltonian, we call these pseudo-classical. So they're diagonal, block diagonal in the energy eigenbasis. What we get is that there are these free energies, which are given by this. They look a bit like Renyi divergences. If people have seen those before, but they're effectively what they are. They're distances from the Gibbs state, from the thermal state. And they're monotones, so they only go down under thermodynamics, under these thermal operations. So what it tells us is that if we want to go from any state rho to any state rho prime, we can only go there if these additional free energies all go down. And there's two nice things about that. One is it turns out to be if and only if. So the second law is usually you think of the third law, the second law is a restriction. So we think, the second law is telling us what we cannot do. We cannot, you know, we cannot violate the second law. But here we see that it not only tells us what we cannot do, but it also gives us, we can also achieve it as well. So if it's not violated, if it's not ruled out by the second law of thermodynamics, then we can do it as a way to go from rho to sigma. Yeah?
A question. How do these pseudo-Renyi entropies come into the picture? Because you have the log over there, but then you have an alpha over here. Is there some kind of physical intuition of why the two should be combined?
I mean, why a log or why an alpha?
Why does that appear in the context of free energy?
And I have the similar question. Is it a Legendre special transform of relative entropies, basically? Is it defined?
No, it is like a relative entropy. So you're right that it's like a... So if you look at if you know what a Renyi entropy is, then it's a relative Renyi entropy.
But what about this additional term?
Which, the log z?
Yeah, that's the usual log entropy.
That's the usual one, and that's because for the Gibbs state, these are all equal to log z. So if I plug the Gibbs state into here, this term here, if you plug the Gibbs state in, you get a log z term. So what you want is that for the, in some sense, this gives you a normalization that says that you're always getting closer to the Gibbs state. So this is zero on the Gibbs state, so you're putting that in.
I guess we can talk about it later.
Yeah. If you plug the Gibbs state into here, you'll see you get this term. Okay. So I think two points worth making. One is that we have second laws which are now necessary and sufficient second laws. And the other thing is that in the macroscopic limit, if you have weak interactions, all these second laws with all the different alphas, they, or all these generalized free energies with these different alphas, they become equal to the ordinary free energy. So you have all these different free energies which govern state transitions. For macroscopic systems, they all become the same quantity. So that explains why this ordinary second law emerges in the macroscopic limit. It's not that these other, you know, these other second laws are still there, they just happen to be all equal. So, and the ordinary one just corresponds to alpha equals one. I should say that they're also, so this is based on, as I mentioned, these Reni divergences. There's various quantum Reni divergences, and they give us some quantum second laws which apply in the case where the state is not block diagonal in the energy eigenbasis. I think David Jennings will talk about some more sophisticated quantum second laws where you have states which are not block diagonal in the energy eigenbasis. But you can get these additional quantum second laws based on something called quantum Reni divergences. So just to remind, just kind of to sum up, ordinarily we have one free energy. It tells us what state transformations are possible and how much work we can extract. It's true in the for macroscopic systems. For microscopic limits, it doesn't give us, there's a whole bunch of additional free energies. One of them corresponds to the amount of work you can get from a state out of equilibrium. The other one, for example, corresponds to how much work, including questions or?
No.
Okay. The other one corresponds to how much the reverse process, how much work is required to make a state. So people that are in entanglement theory, you'll remember there's the distillable entanglement and the entanglement of formation. You can think of two of these work functions or these free energies as telling you about how much being analogous, so how much work is required to make a state, how much work can you get back from the state. In the macroscopic limit, these are both equal. If you put work into a system, you can get it back. If you do the process in reverse, here you cannot do things reversibly. Right? And you get, and this is what they look like for those who are experts. So just say we can, I'll maybe jump a bit. So we can effectively use this to calculate the work of transition between any two states. I'll maybe just mention a few, let me just mention some toy examples of getting work from quantum states now. What I want to say is, and we can get the work, we can figure out how much, we have these criteria now, these different free energies, and they allow us to basically tell us whether we can go from one state to any other state. A particular example of this is if we want to extract work from, say, an atom in a box. So I'm going to go through that example just because it's a particularly simple one, although I don't think it really captures necessarily the full extent of what kinds of things we're interested in, because you may or may not be interested in how much work you can extract. And in fact, work extraction in this paradigm can be a bit funny in some ways, and you'll see that here. So let me give the example I gave at the beginning. Imagine we have a box with two partitions. We want to extract work, and we have this molecule here. We know it's on the left-hand side. If we know it's on, so with probability one, it's on the left-hand side, and then we can extract one bit of work by putting a piston in the middle of the box and extracting one bit of work. Right, that's just the Zillard box. If, on the other hand, we know only that the probability of it being on the left-hand side is 2/3 and the probability of it being on the right-hand side is 1/3, then we cannot extract work, at least in a deterministic way. And that's because some of the time we guess it right, so we put the piston in and the molecule pushes us back, but some of the time we get it wrong. And when we get it wrong, we lose one bit of work. Right? So if we don't, if the probabilities are 2/3, 1/3, then we cannot deterministically extract work in this case. More generally, you might have a box with many probabilities, and some of them are going to be very small or zero. And in that case, we can extract work. Whenever we know that the chance of the molecule not being any particular partition is small, we can always extract work by just moving all the boxes onto the right-hand side, sticking our piston in and extracting work. And the amount of work we can generally extract is given by the rank of the density matrix, right? It's given by how many states are occupied versus how many states there are. So you see that for distillation, what turns out to be important is the rank of the density matrix. For work of formation, now we want to do the opposite process. We want to create the state which had probably two-thirds of being on the left-hand side, probably one-third of being on the right-hand side. In order to do that, we start off with the molecule just anywhere. We push our piston in a certain amount until the probability of the molecule being on the left-hand side is two-thirds, so we push it in one-quarter of the way in, and then we stick in a partition, and that allows us to form the state with probability two-thirds of being on the left-hand side. In general, the amount of work we have to put in is given by the largest probability. All right? So the larger the probability of the molecule being on the left-hand side, the more we'd have to push in this piston. So you see here that the distillable work is related to the rank of the density matrix. The work of formation is related to the largest eigenvalue. And so you get this irreversibility here in the quantum regime, or in the regime of small particles. And I'll just say, so I'm running out of time, so let me just kind of skip ahead a bit. In the case where you don't have a degenerate Hamiltonian, things become a lot more complicated. You need to consider the degeneracy of the heat bath depending on the energy level of the system. And effectively what happens is, in the case when the Hamiltonian is trivial, we show that state transformations are allowed if and only if given by the majorization condition. So you can only go from rho to sigma if sigma majorizes rho. In the case of full thermodynamics, we say that we can only go from rho to sigma if sigma thermo majorizes rho. So you get a changing of the majorization rule when going from trivial Hamiltonian to a non-trivial Hamiltonian. The key point is that in thermodynamics, what we find that's more fundamental than entropy is this majorization rule. Majorization is that you order all the eigenvalues from largest to smallest, and rho majorizes sigma if and only if all the sums of the largest eigenvalues are larger than the partial sums of the target state. Okay. Sorry, that wasn't very clear because I was trying to rush, but let me just finally get to the following point. So we have a set of rules which tells us whether we can go from rho to sigma. And we can now apply it not just to rho and sigma, but also to any ancilla. So now we're not in a working body, right? We have a working body now. So we want to know, can we go, say, from x to y? But we might have a working body. So what we should really ask is, we have x and z, and we want to go to y and z. So it's a catalytic, we're interested in catalytic transformations. So Z may be the working body. So we have X, we want to go to Y. So we ask, is there a Z such that we can go from X tensor Z to Y tensor Z? And that turns out to be a harder question to ask. And it turns out that, and you are able to derive the Renyi divergences from the considerations there by trying to say, does there ever exist an ancilla which will allow us to make the transition? And now comes the problem. We had an ancilla. It allowed us to make the transition. We had to put it back into the same state that we started off with. And now we need to ask, how well should we put it back into its original state? And it turns out that the rules of thermodynamics will change depending on how close we put the ancilla back into its original state. And there's a process called embezzling, which was discovered in the context of entanglement theory. But what embezzling tells you is that if you just say, I want you to put your environment back into its same state, such that the initial state and the out state differ only by some epsilon in fidelity, it turns out you can always construct a state which will allow you to extract an arbitrary large amount of work from the heat bath. Okay? And so that what that means is that when people say that we want something to be approximately cyclic, that's not good enough. You need to be really careful about what you mean by approximately cyclic. And what we find is that there are actually three different families of second laws depending on what you mean by how cyclic. So if you just mean approximately cyclic, then you can do everything and thermodynamics becomes trivial. If you say, I want it to be cyclic, I want it to be approximate, but I have some, in terms of dimension of the log dimension of the catalyst, then it turns out that you get the ordinary second law, just the free energy. And if you demand that it should be much more cyclic, then you get all these additional free energies. Right? So there's a whole family of possible second laws which arise. So just let me mention some kind of future work. So I like to consider second laws to be the second laws are like telling us what state transformations are possible. So let me end on this. Second laws are telling me what state transformations are possible. We now might want to try and understand what about coherences over energy levels. And David has done some nice work in that, and we'll be talking about that, I guess, in the next session. You might ask about probabilistic transformations. So in the thermodynamic limit, if the free energy is not going down, there's actually zero probability of you being able to go and make the transition, right? So the free energy tells you whether something's possible. If you want to say, well, can I just go there with some probability? It turns out the probability goes to zero in the thermodynamic limit. It turns out for quantum systems and small systems, you can sometimes make a transformation, even if the free energy tells you that you can't. And you can do so probabilistically. Okay? So in some sense, you can think of it like you can probabilistically violate. I don't like saying this because it can be open to the wrong interpretation, but you can probabilistically violate the second law in the case of small systems. And I think there's a fair bit of other future directions in that respect. So let me just end with this conclusion. We've been interested in laws of thermodynamics, and we've been able to reformulate them as a resource theory, meaning that the resource theory that we call thermodynamics, one can consider the first law to tell us that energy is conserved. Once we do that, once we formulate thermodynamics as a resource theory, we get a zeroth law merging, which defines temperature for us. We get a whole family of second laws, all of which must be obeyed. So they impose additional restrictions on what's allowed in thermodynamics. They're all equal to the standard second law in the macroscopic limit. We have some strange phenomenon called work embezzlement, which means we have to be very careful about how cyclic, what we mean by a cyclic transformation in thermodynamics. And generally we get all these limitations in thermodynamics due to both finite size effects and due to quantum coherences. So thanks very much for your attention.
Say a few words about your results on probabilistic state transformations.
Right, so I guess here's a question. Say you want to go from rho to, so this is joint work with, it's on the archive, it's joint work with two students of mine, Chris Perry and Alvaro Alumbra. Let's say you want to go from rho to sigma and it costs work to do that. That effectively means that you cannot do it without work, you might think. Or at least you can't just do it deterministically without work. You'll never be able to go from rho to sigma without work if the work cost is positive, if you need work to do it. So then you can ask, well, can I go there probabilistically? Is there some? If I don't have access to a work system, what's the chance of me going there? And it turns out that you can do it. There is a, usually a probability that you can do it. It turns out to be it's bounded by the amount of work that's required, e to the minus beta times the work that's required to go there. And it's bound in the other direction from the amount of work that's required to do the reverse process. And what that means is that in the macroscopic, if it was a macroscopic system, you find that the probability is proportional to e to the minus beta times the free energy difference between your initial and final state. And for a macroscopic system, if you have some large gas and you take the thermodynamic limit, that goes to zero.
So to achieve the post-selection that says you've succeeded,
right,
you need a measurement device.
Right.
A lot of resource theories, that's free.
Yes.
But here, the initial state of the measurement device is a pure state. That's athermal. Are you taking into account the cost of having the measurement device?
No. So what we say is, so that's a good question. So what we say is, you have some rho, and what you want to go is, you're looking at going to P times some sigma plus 1 minus P times some other state X. And we just ask for the transformation that we can do this.
I see.
We ask what's the probability that we can do this transformation. Then you, as the experimenter, can come in and make the measurement. It turns out there is a deterministic measurement you can do, which will tell you whether you're here or here. But that will cost you one bit. But you might not care if this state is a very large one, which, you know, one bit may or may not be large depending on the sorts of quantities you're interested in. So if you're interested in large, if the work cost is fairly large, for example, and going from rho to sigma, you might not care about this one bit of work that you've lost by performing the measurement. But we don't count that as the cost. So we're interested in the largest probability that you can make P here. And that turns out to be achievable, at least in the case of quasi-classics. I garbled there at the end of my talk, so maybe not very.
Yeah, that's not the case. Let's thank Jonathan again.